Hey, this is Malcolm Brogdon, and this is the Sideline Guys podcast.
Hi, Pacers fans. We welcome you back to another Sideline Guys Wednesday. We hope you had a nice all-star break. I know JJ and I did. We took a brief 1 week off the podcast, but we are here. We're back. There's tons to talk about. A bunch happened between the last time we spoke all the way back, JJ, to that phenomenal night from TJ McConnell, the all-star weekend, some much-needed time off, I think, and then what is the beginning? Now you're maybe almost halfway through, I think, the most grueling stretch of schedule that the Pacers will have all year. Kind of depends on where you draw the line there, but as we come to you now, the Pacers are off of that three-game Western Conference road trip. You lost game one in Los Angeles, you win game two in Phoenix, and you fall the third game in Denver. I think one out of three in that grouping is by no means bad, but it is a little bit frustrating when you led in the fourth quarter of all three of those games. But I don't want to bury the lead here. Caris LeVert's return is the main story. It's probably, the biggest development of the Pacers season. Save maybe the trade for LeVert, and with Victor Oladipo out, we've only seen two games of him. They've been on the road. You know, you're not even in the arena like you typically would be. So I think we're maybe even like single-digit percent from understanding exactly the player he's going to be, the fit he's going to have, and all of that. But I am wondering, just a couple games in, what were your takeaways of LeVert?
It was similar to what we had discussed prior to the All-Star break, that I thought they just needed a different kind of player at that two-guard position. And what we saw in Phoenix, and it was something that Miles Turner even noted after the game, defense is already throwing some double teams. They're aware of where he's at on the court and what he can do, and he just brings a different skill set, perhaps making things easier for Malcolm Brogdon and Domantas Sabonis. So you in no way can expect through two games to get the best of Caris LeVert. He is obviously going to take some time to get back into the swing of things and that pace of an NBA game, and you saw that when he checked out of that first game in Phoenix. He had played 6 minutes, and I think he was supposed to only play 5 minutes, and there was no stoppage in play from the 7 minute mark to about 5 minutes and 50 seconds when Doug McDermott, I think, was waiting to check in, and I think our cameras caught him saying, "I'm tired," and then in the second quarter he got 8 points, and it was great to just see him on the court. It was great to see the Pacers win against the team with the second best record in the Western Conference. And you saw some glimpses of what they are capable of. So in general, the other thing is when he had that surgery, you didn't even care when he came back. You just wanted him to be healthy. But I'm not sure that I had any thought that March would be the month we would be talking about him. I just kind of had thought maybe mid-April would be the best case scenario, and you could get him for a month and maybe see if he could be at his best in the playoff. And you basically got him the first game of the second half of the season. The Pacers had played 36 games prior to the Phoenix game. Game number 37, he is on the court. So I think that is great, a great sign for optimism. A couple of weeks ago on our Pacers Live pregame, Ken Sothman had Eddie Gill and I do a glass half full outlook on things. When you've lost 4 out of 5, 5 out of 6, you're just looking for something to kind of be positive about. And so we were positive about the prospects of getting Caris LeVert, but even then we didn't know when it would be. And so just seeing him out there, seeing him make it through two games and show some signs of the reason the Pacers were so interested in acquiring him is a great thing. And I think from our perspective, we often share maybe some selfish reasons that we're happy about things, but I enjoy having the opportunity to interview Caris LeVert. I wish I could do it in person, but even the walk-off interview on Saturday and even on Pacers Live post-game after what was, you know, a really disappointing fourth quarter and loss to Denver, I thought he had some really good comments. So I'm looking forward to having him be on the court, be in the mix, and be an option offensively and defensively, and I think more wins will come because he's available.
Yeah, I think back to mid-January and then late January, those two dates where the trade happened and then you found out the medical news of Caris LeVert. And there was so much unknown. I mean, that Kevin Pritchard kind of impromptu press conference where he was trying to be as forthright as he could. But the reality was there's just a lot of sensitive information that he couldn't talk about. And so much was still up in the air. He didn't have a ton of answers at that point. And then we found out a couple weeks later that he, you know, underwent surgery. I think the date was like January 25th or something. Something like 48 days after surgery, this guy's back on an NBA floor playing. It's remarkable. I'm with you. I think I was very hopeful to get him this year. And as we got closer, you know, you started to learn some little nuggets in practice about how, you know, he was involved and how it seemed like he was getting closer and closer. So my timeline started to get a little earlier and earlier. But even then, even within the last couple of weeks, as it became apparent that his return was sooner rather than later, I think a lot of us maybe had the Nets game pegged, which is, you know, coming up here tonight. If you're listening when we are recording or when we are releasing this, we're recording it on a Tuesday, the night before. But to get him back that quickly, it's just remarkable. I think it's a testament to modern medicine. It's a testament to, you know, his work ethic and his mindset to get back. And you're right. Like, you watch him, and he even, that was the first thing he said after that game. My conditioning's not there. I need to get my conditioning up. He said he only played in 5-on-5 one time before that Phoenix game. A couple of things stood out to me. I thought, you know, he did look winded. I thought at times he looked like, you know, he was trying not to do too much. I think that can be a real challenge when you bring a guy into a new system. And he is known for being a scorer and is known for being a dynamic playmaker, but he doesn't want to come in and upset the apple cart. He doesn't want to come in and start, you know, trying to do too much too soon. And Miles Turner had, I thought, an interesting comment after that Phoenix game, basically saying after the first quarter, I thought he was, you know, trying to set us up too much. And I told him, man, you got to get your own and you got to take your shots. And then, you know, lo and behold, in the third quarter, Turner pointed out that Phoenix started double teaming him. And that's really what set up that massive third quarter run, which I think is perhaps the best the Pacers have played all season, that 21-3 run against Phoenix, which in hindsight ended up putting the game away. But, I think he still looks like he's figuring out the Pacers system. I think he still looks a little bit rusty. I think he still looks like he's getting his conditioning back. And I say all of those things in a complimentary way because he's been, you know, he's had an impact on the team, on the games he's been in. There's no denying that the Pacers have been better with him on the floor. And I don't think we've seen, you know, probably anything close to 100% version of LeVert. And I think it's important, as you noted, and Malcolm Brogdon said, it's important to be patient. I know we're midway through the year here and you're getting closer and closer to the stretch run. And if you're a Pacers fan, you obviously want them to turn things around just a little bit. But it's important to note, you know, this isn't like when you're playing NBA 2K and then all of a sudden the guy gets healthy and you plug him into the lineup and everything is perfect. There's so much he's undergoing mentally, physically. I mean, think about what 2 months ago was like for him. Not to mention, you've got a new system, new teammates, all of that. It's a whole lot to be thrown at you in an offseason. It's a tremendous amount to be thrown at you midway through the season. And I do think it's going to take a little bit of time. But that one kind of thing I was looking for, and it's not tangible, but that one thing I wanted to see was, how do the Pacers look with him on the floor? Do they have the look of a team that can rise their ceiling from where it has been? And I think he has checked those boxes, and I think he seems to be a really good fit, and we'll still be learning about this story and all of the ways he can impact this team in the next month or so, I think. But those initial first impressions, I think you have to be pretty pleased with.
And I think the one thing that people need to understand, and we tried to maybe caution people to have too high of expectations or think that Caris LeVert would come in and just immediately fix all of the problems. And I even talked to a number of people on Sunday that were, you know, just out in the community. Hey, Pacers had a good win. And I'm like, yeah, they're 1-0 with Caris LeVert. And then I had to catch myself, you know, even saying that, it just makes everyone think, well, now Caris LeVert's here and they're just going to go in and win every game. And then you saw some of the good that he can provide, but really some of the same problems we've seen from this team all in that 148-minute game against the Denver Nuggets. And so I don't think he played poorly against the Nuggets. I think it's just another step in the progression. I think maybe the minutes, I don't have the box score in front of me. I think he played 27 minutes on Saturday and probably right around there, maybe just a little bit more. But I didn't think he was limited by a minutes restriction. But I thought the team against the Nuggets still had those inconsistent moments, and maybe we would call them inconsistent quarters. And that's really gone back, you know, to previous seasons. And that's one thing I think that somehow they're going to have to try to figure out, is make the bad quarters not quite as bad, or make the, the runs not be 17-0, but make them, or 22-2, but yeah. stop them at 12-2. And I think that it's easier said than done. And I know it's, if anyone's listening in basketball, they're like, yeah, no kidding, Jeremiah. We don't want to give up a 22-2 run. But it's just kind of one of those things that they've got to kind of figure out. And I think Harris can help. But he's not going to be the person that you just magically, you know, play him and everything else that has been a little bit of an issue will just go away every single game.
Totally agree. And we spent a fair amount of time, or at least I spent a fair amount of time on the last podcast talking about the runs and how I felt like that was maybe the area that they needed to fix the most. Look, it's the NBA. Runs are going to happen. But I think you need to find a way to keep the 22-2 type of runs being more like 12-2 runs. And you look at that Phoenix game, and that's what happened. The Pacers were able to get a big run. Phoenix went on a couple of mini runs in the fourth quarter, but the Pacers kept it from being debilitating. And unfortunately, in the two games that sandwiched that Phoenix game, that wasn't the case. And, you know, you find yourself, I think, maybe a little bit frustrated, although ultimately bigger picture optimistic, or at least that's where I am with what we've seen post All-Star break, because you played three really good teams on the road. One out of three is just fine. But the way they played, I think for most of the road trip, was pretty inspiring. You led by 12 points in the fourth quarter against the Lakers. You put forth one of your best games of the year against Phoenix, who, by the way, had won 17 of 20 going in and five in a row. So this is team with the second best record in the league and was the hottest team in the NBA. And you dispelled of them and never really had to hold on tight at the end, even although Phoenix did make things interesting. And then you've got a 5-point lead going into the fourth against Denver, and it just doesn't stick. And, you know, it's like you're going to lose some of those close games on the road against good teams. But if you could have just closed one of those two better, and you talk about the runs, I don't have it in front of me, but it was something along the lines of 22-2 for Denver and 22-4, I think, for LA in the fourth quarter. If those are more like 12-0, maybe two different stories, especially that LA game. So I kind of find myself on two different platforms here watching the Pacers post All-Star break, because I think, like, I don't know, 10 of the 12 quarters you've played have been, you know, pretty hope inspiring, pretty optimistic laden. But the other two quarters that weren't involved, in my opinion, your biggest problem that you've had over the last month was still problematic. And one of those came in the Caris LeVert, you know, return. The LA game was before he was there, but Caris LeVert was there for the final game. So to your point, it's not quite just like waving a magic wand. And, you know, at some point you're going to have to play better in the fourth quarter. I know Nate Bjorkgren has talked about this as much as anything, and their fourth quarter execution, Malcolm Brogdon as well, and avoiding those big runs. But, you know, I thought overall level of play, you're more optimistic now, certainly, than you were a couple weeks ago. But that red flag is still there, and I think it's something they're going to continue to need to work on.
And I think, you know, it's one thing to say, yeah, they won one of those three games, and those were challenging games against Western Conference playoff opponents, so it's okay. But you look at the schedule coming up, I really do put a lot of importance on these next four or five games against really good Eastern Conference competition, because those are the kind of teams, if you get where you want to be in the playoffs, you're going to have to compete with and or beat. And you've got Brooklyn, and you've got Miami, and Milwaukee. And it's one thing to say, well, the schedule is going to get easier in April, so they can make up some ground against those teams. However, if you are in the playoffs where you want to be, you're going to most likely, I mean, I could even say of those three teams, there is a pretty good chance if you get in the playoffs, you might have to play one of those three teams. And so I want to go into that playoffs feeling like you've got a shot. And I think there's no reason why they can't, in these next four or five games, be competitive and win some of these games. Let's not just say, hey, you know, you're going to have to go win 8 out of 10 in April to make up the ground you lost because you played these really good teams. The Pacers showed at Staples Center against the Lakers, at Phoenix, at Denver. They can be right there. Now, they've just got to learn to finish. And the only thing that I'm a little concerned with is it's something that I think I felt in that Boston playoff series of the, oh, no, here we go again when you have these bad quarters. And you don't want to get in a situation where things start to go awry in the fourth quarter. And even as a player, you're thinking, oh, no, here we go again. You've got to be able to stop that. You've got to pull some of these games out. And I do think what this team really needs, and I'm not going to say they're going to have a 4 or 5 game winning streak in the next week, but I do think they need one of these weeks or 2 weeks of times where they win 4 out of 5 and there are less doubts. Because I think right now they're all saying the right things. I think they still believe in the system and what they're trying to accomplish, but it's still a results business. And you can only, for so long, continue to believe something if it's not happening. And you can go back to mid-January. This is where this team, when the Victor Oladipo trade happened, let's be honest, from that point on, you've just had a lot of inconsistency. And if anything has been consistent, it's been, you know, I don't know, I don't have the numbers, but it feels like they've probably lost 2 out of every 3 since then, maybe. And they had a nice start to the season. So you almost got a fresh start with Caris LeVert. And I'm willing to kind of say that month and a half wasn't really fair, because without Warren and LeVert, you're just not at full strength in a way that can really compete with another full strength NBA team. Now you've got LeVert, you get him closer to 100%, but I think the time is now to start to get some confidence. And I still think the opportunity is definitely there. And we're in this business, especially with social media and fan interaction. You know, the way you felt about the Pacers on Sunday was great. And now you wake up and you're like, oh, the sky is falling. And I can be guilty of feeling that way as well, but you have to make sure the players don't feel that way. That's the one thing. I'm pretty confident the coaching staff is still optimistic and confident about things, but I think the players, just for their own sake, the next maybe 2 to 3 weeks, I feel is pretty important for them to kind of regain that confidence and make everything that they're saying be exactly what they're feeling, and that this can come back around and they can start to play the brand of basketball that they did, where they were winning 2 out of every 3, not losing 2 out of every 3.
Yeah, the Pacers were 7-4 when the Oladipo trade happened. And then they went, I think it was 9-16 after that, up into the LeVert return. And, you know, they're 1-1 since LeVert return, with 2 tough games on the road. And one you felt like you at least should have been in it against Denver, had that, you know, big run not come. And this is something that is a lot more challenging from our perspective to get a pulse on, is just, you know, where the team is mentally. And it's tough anyway. Like, we get great access to these players, and for the most part, they're, willing interviewees and, help us tell the story of the team. It's just a lot harder over Zoom, but I would say I do get the sense that this LeVert return is coming at exactly a time when they needed it. You know, 9-16, that's over 25, that's 25 games. That's over a third of the season. So if nothing else, I think they just needed a shakeup. And obviously when that shakeup can be a close to 20 point per game guy coming back, I do think, from just a mental standpoint, it's helped turn the page. And, you're right. This next stretch of schedule, it's still pretty brutal. Brooklyn, Miami, Milwaukee, which Miami is starting to play extremely well lately. I think as of recording this, they've won 10 of 11. And those are going to be important games against Miami. You're going to have Miami again on March 31st. So probably unrealistic to hope that, you're going to get 4 of the next 5 or something like that. But to me, it's all about how they look. If they can manage 2-2, but they're looking, competitive and they're in all of these games, I'll view this next stretch of 4 games as a win personally. Because I think it's challenging to judge where this team is considering how tough the schedule is. This team is with LeVert, with how tough the schedule is, but you can get a sense for how they look against some of the better teams. And at least post All-Star break, they have been right there with all of those teams. They defeated Phoenix and got up by 20 against the Suns. They were leading in all 3 of those games going into the fourth quarter. And so, can they continue to look the part of a team that is elevated off of that 9-16 stretch that we were just talking about? Can, that continue to gain confidence? And like you said, can the fourth quarters bring back less, or bring out, I guess, less negative memories? And it's hard to know how much that can affect a player or a team, but the Lakers game the other day, the Nuggets game the other day, You go back to Boston. I mean, the Pacers have struggled in the fourth quarter in a lot of these games, and it's something where I think Caris LeVert helps this team immensely. It gives them a third scoring option. Unfortunately, you didn't see the impact of that in game two versus Denver, but again, it's only his second game. So I think as I look at these next handful of games coming up, it's going to be very challenging, you know, to make any headway in the standings. Hopefully they do it, but it's you have to be realistic here. It's going to be challenging, but if you can continue to play at a level where you are competing with all these teams you're playing against, which are some of the top teams in the NBA, and if you can start to make inroads on the fourth quarter problems, then to me that's a win, regardless of record. You're not going to go 0-4 over the stretch if you are accomplishing those things. So to me, obviously, you've got a standings chase that's on right now. You're not where you want to be, and the results are what's most important here. And at some point, you know, we really need to start thinking more results oriented, but at least for me right now, that's not totally the case over these next handful of games because of how challenging the schedule is. And they're still getting LeVert back. And I think there's a natural period for him that it's going to take some time for him, you know, to get his legs under him in so many different ways. But once you're out of this four game stretch, he'll have played in six. He'll have played at home, had a couple weeks under his belt, a little more than that even. And I think it's then realistic to, you know, start to hope that this team starts to turn the corner, because that's ultimately the question here. Can they turn the corner? And if so, how much ground can they make up? Fortunately, they didn't dig themselves a big hole, but they are in a little bit of a hole right now. You know, you're out of the top eight. You're in that play-in matchup, and those are very challenging, you know, odds to overcome if you're not in the seven or the eight matchup. And frankly, this team wants to be ahead of that. So all of those goals you want to hit, they're still right there. But also, you know, if each week that passes by gives you less time to accomplish those, and it's going to be tough, you know, to make inroads in these next four games. So I think it's a very important time in the schedule, as you said, just to kind of get your confidence about you, even if it might not, hopefully it will, but even if it might not show in the win-loss column.
We did not discuss this prior to the podcast, so I might be putting you on the spot a little bit, and I don't know where you weigh in on this, but I did want to ask you one specific question about something that happened in the game against Denver. The Domantas Sabonis getting elbowed in the face, and they go to the replay monitor, and it takes me back to the Boston-New York weekend, where in Boston, Sabonis gets issued a flagrant foul upon replay review, and then in New York, what seemed to me like something, I don't know, a little bit similar, even though the play was different. And maybe if what happened in Boston didn't happen, I wouldn't have necessarily thought that the New York incident should have been a flagrant foul. So that's three examples now. And yeah, we're a Pacers podcast, and maybe I can tend to be a little more frustrated or critical of the officiating than some. And I know that nobody's perfect, but when you go to the monitor, you have the opportunity to be about as perfect as you can be. And I thought that was a little bit of a turning point, because not only did it, you know, add a free throw to Denver, but it really frustrated Domas. Who knows what, whether, I mean, hopefully he's okay right now, but you know, he was bleeding, I think, a little bit, and had to wear, you know, things in his nose, gauze. And I think, Mark, if I remember the play correctly as I'm talking, Michael Porter Jr. goes up for the rebound, and where the elbow was nowhere necessary to where your arms need to be to get the ball. And it was elbow to the face. So the way they're calling flagrant fouls now, I just don't understand how that's not a foul. And I do think it shook up Domas. It frustrated him. Then he went down a couple other times and wanted calls that didn't get them. And it really got him all out of sorts for the rest of the game. And Edmund Sumner right before halftime, I think, by the end of the third quarter, got his arm ripped off. And when I saw what I saw against the Lakers on the first game after the All-Star break, where it was just a nonstop parade to the free throw line, am I wrong for being frustrated?
I don't think you're wrong for being frustrated, because when you talk about those three calls, we're going to have a little bit of a differing opinion here, but where I think I agree with you the most in what you just said is, I would say that when Sabonis got that flagrant foul in Boston, I was about as shocked at the result of a review as I can remember. And so my opinion is that all three, I think the one last night was of the three, to me, that was the closest. But my opinion is, I don't think any of those are flagrant fouls, and I'm just fine with the NBA not making them flagrant fouls, because you know, I guess that's just such a big call, and it's a way that, you know, can change the momentum of a game so much. And look, the game has changed from the 90s. You know, it kind of depends on your perspective on how you view some of this. But just personally, I'm okay with all of those calls not being called flagrant.
Me too. Yeah, Boston, I don't want to interrupt. I agree with you.
I thought the one against Boston was totally incorrect. And I was I said it on air. I was as shocked as I have been. And you know, to your point, I thought the Edmund one was a foul as well. It's tough to know the impact of that, especially when we're not there. And that's something that you can give us a better feel for when you're normally traveling and we're having these conversations. But, you know, I would like to see, I guess, easier said than done. But maybe if something like that does have an effect, like just being able to turn the page maybe a little bit more quickly, because that's unfortunately out of your control. And I'll tell you, it was really shocking, and this really is not fair to him because he is so darn consistent. But it was really shocking to see Sabonis have a moment where he was, you know, he was struggling as much as he was, because the guy just doesn't have that happen almost ever. And even when he's struggling, you know, he finds other ways to affect the game, which he did against Denver. Don't get me wrong, but you know, that was probably as challenging of a stretch, I think, as he has had all season in that fourth quarter. And look, that fourth quarter was, you know, far more than just one player, that 22-2 run. But yeah, there was just a lot of reasons to be frustrated, I think, with that fourth quarter. And one of them being, you know, you played so well to get yourself out of that early 12-point hole, that 20-point hole in the second quarter, and it kind of felt like you had righted the ship, and then, you know, the floor fell out again. So, you know,
I thought I mean, here's what I would say. Domantas Sabonis is a two-time All-Star, and at some point it would be nice to feel like he was given a little bit of that same respect that I feel like other All-Stars are. If they're frustrated, if LeBron, and he's on another level, but if he's frustrated, it does feel like the next time or two down the court, whether he gets fouled or not, if it's close, he's going to get the benefit of the doubt. And to me, repeatedly, Domas does not. Now, do I think that he's been a little bit too much complaining this season? Yes, I think he's got to figure out a way to move past that. But because he's so strong and he doesn't react to contact as much as the average player, he's penalized for that. And I think that's might be my biggest issue. And then to go back on the flagrant thing, I agree. I don't like it when someone puts their head into someone's elbow and then gets a flagrant called. I don't think Domas was doing that on purpose, but you could argue, you know, hey, he kind of moved toward the elbow. But to that point, I'll go all the way back to Miami. And the most ridiculous call I think I've ever seen is that Thaddeus Young not only got a flagrant, but a flagrant two and ejected when Kelly Olynyk just decided to put his nose right exactly in Thad Young's elbow. And I've never gotten a good explanation of that. And so I'm just so conflicted when they go to the monitor, I have no idea what they're looking for. And I think that's disappointing because fans don't either. And I think that the NBA is trying to make the officiating as transparent as possible. But for those that see every single game, Chris and Quinn, I know they don't have any idea what is and what isn't, and it shouldn't be that hard.
Right. No, and unfortunately, what you don't want to happen is you don't want this to turn into like the NFL's issue with what a catch is and isn't, right? I mean, I think they're just starting to shore some of that up. But, you know, you go on Twitter during an NFL game, and if they're reviewing that, your Twitter feed just turns into, I have no idea what the catch rule is. Who knows what this is going to be? And that's what you don't want, obviously, with this situation. And the language in the rule book is unnecessary for flagrant and unnecessary and excessive for flagrant too, which is pretty vague. You know, it keeps a lot open for interpretation. So I don't know. You know, I hadn't really thought about it too much, but there is some sort of way to narrow in and be a lot more specific. And it's challenging. Like, you know, what's the angle of guys' elbows? If you're out at a 90 degree angle, that's obviously not okay. If you're straight up, that's obviously okay. And then where does the middle ground fall? Porter did have his elbows out a little bit. And I think that's what's challenging, is where is that fine line of where your elbows should be and where they shouldn't be. And look, I'm frankly not somebody that's necessarily been frustrated with the NBA's calling these flagrants more often, just very generally, because I think you have to protect your biggest assets, which are the players, and you don't want guys getting hit above the head a whole lot. It's a fine line because you also don't want a bunch of flagrant calls deciding games and to get any sort of appearance that, you know, the league is soft or anything either. But you know, maybe I'll take some time and think about this and maybe we can revisit it on a future podcast, because the scenarios that you're talking about also have come up in major parts of the game. And as you talked about a second ago, have been kind of swing moments too. So yeah, but you know, I agree with you. Unfortunately on our broadcast, you know, part of what I try to do on the radio side is be as much of an expert as I can on the replay center and the review system. You know, that's just not totally Mark Boyle's forte. So I try to make it mine. So that way we have.
So have you been predicting, you know, these, whether you think they will or won't be?
In general, we make predictions. Yeah. Yeah.
And have so those, let's say the three instances that we've discussed, you said for all three that none of them should have been. Is that what you thought?
I said no on all three. And, the most surprised of any of those three rulings, though, was the Boston one. I still don't get that one. I would like to have it explained like you would the Thaddeus Young one. Because yeah. What I think then unfortunately happens, too, is then Sabonis says, OK, well, if I do this, then when this happens to me, I should get the equal call. Well, you've got different officials in different games and people, you know, if official A makes an error in judgment on a replay call like that, and officials B and C, I'm just talking, you know, more theoretically here, call it correctly, then you feel like you're getting hosed, if you will, when it's really just official A who made the wrong call in the first place. And that's not the definition you should be using. I'm not saying that's the case, yeah. But that's what's hard, too, is everybody has a different interpretation. And if B and C, look, they're all close. But if the second and the third ones were called correctly and the first one wasn't, I can see how, if you're Sabonis, that's frustrating because you just want the same thing when it happens to you to happen to the guy that when you're on the landing end of one of those shots to happen. So, I certainly understand how that's frustrating for Sabonis. And I definitely think that Boston call was off.
Well, to your credit, I know you're not someone who, you know, blames the officials or even spends as much time thinking about it as I might. And, you know, that's all about sort of perspective and personality. And on our broadcast, we're not doing that either. But in this platform, I felt like I did have an opportunity because I do think, I mean, it was only necessarily, you know, one point. But I feel like in kind of thinking back to when things started to kind of start to go awry, it was the third quarter and the Pacers had that lead, but I do think it affected Domas, and I can't blame him for feeling that way. Again, I think he needs to not let every time he misses a shot look at the officials. I think then you get to the little boy who cried wolf. And even though there are other players in the league that do the exact same thing and they do get those calls, for whatever reason he's not going to. And so if he's got to sell it more, or if when he goes up he's got to fall down, then so be it. But I was even surprised, I guess, those two times. Sometimes when he gets hit in the head, they don't even review it. When I think if at least you get him to the monitor, then it should be pretty much fair that if it is, it is called. And then I guess that I just still go back to that Celtics one has jaded my view of what is and what isn't. So
I understand the officials are doing, you know, the best they can. And sometimes it's, you know, we can be broadcasters, but a little bit of fan can creep in. So glad I was able to just kind of share those thoughts, and we turn the page and we move on. And I think that Domantas Sabonis will be fired up and ready to go on Wednesday night against Brooklyn. And Pat, this should be a really entertaining week if you're watching Pacers basketball. But if you're just a basketball fan, I don't know that the week ahead, it doesn't really get much better than this.
It doesn't get much better than this the entire month. Look, we certainly wish COVID did not force these extreme measures, but I will tell you, there's been this shirt that has been going around that I think Visit Indy or somebody, the Sports Corp. There are so many hands that are touching this tournament here from a city perspective, and it's just been really impressive to me to watch it. I've gotten the chance to be kind of on the fringe of one of the committees, and so it's been really cool to watch it all come together. But anyway, the shirt's a basketball, and it just says Indy in the middle, and it says made for this, and I think that's so true. The city and the state is so perfect for these challenging circumstances, and there's no doubt in my mind that they're going to nail it. I think everybody loves that first Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday of March Madness. I know I think it's pushed back a day this year, but those first 4 days are as exciting as I think just about any on the sports calendar. And, you know, it's amazing because you're thinking about all of these teams that are in the city and that are going to play, and they're spread out throughout all these different hotels. And Bankers Life Fieldhouse is a major site of these games, too. And then also the fact that the Pacers are going to play there in between some of it, including on Wednesday. And we're going to be broadcasting basically, 200 yards away, maybe not even, maybe 100 yards away from the court where all these games are going to be playing. I was actually just looking up, about to look up the schedule to see who might be playing when we are in there on Friday. And obviously with all these COVID protocols, just like within the NBA, we're going to be severely restricted to where we can and can't go. And I think basically you'll be allowed up into your loft and we'll be allowed down into the studio. And that's probably about it, which means, for those who don't know, I go down into a different room within the building to do those post-game interviews where there's a backdrop and there's good lighting and all that stuff. And those interview rooms are, of course, going to be used for the tournament. So I've got to figure out a spot and a space to do our post-game interviews. But I think it's such a cool moment for the city. You wish it didn't have to happen. But since it does, this is a no better city, state. And Bankers Life Fieldhouse is obviously a world-class facility. And it'll just be cool, experiencing all of that. And for you, I know you've had this before. There have been the high school finals, I think wrestling maybe two, and maybe a concert or two in there. But it's always nice when we can see your shot, because we go off the TV feed for radio, so we see all of what you guys do too, when your TV shot has some people behind you.
Yeah, Disney on Ice, I think, was the first time that I was there another event that was going on. And that was even fun, just to see people in the building. I don't know this to be a fact, but I'm guessing some of the banners that are hanging inside the entry pavilion will be taken down after the game on Wednesday, and it will have a definite NCAA look to it. I know that the crew that works in facilities, they've got quite a chore on their hands for once that Nets game ends to turn it over into an NCAA building, and I believe practices will be on the court on Thursday. I just wish it could be that maybe Indiana at some time in the future, maybe the reward could be you did this, you helped everybody out, and maybe one time in the future you could have Indiana host everything again when it could be fully open, and it could just be a basketball festival that you didn't have to tiptoe around and be careful of where you were sitting and going and walking. And is it okay to go in this restaurant because it's a little bit crowded? That's right. Kind of the conflict that I'm kind of dealing with. And even this first weekend, the Pacers play Friday, Sunday, Monday. So Saturday is open. And I did actually, just like a fan, I got on one of the websites, Ticketmaster, to try to get a few tickets for one of those Saturday games, actually at Lucas Oil. And so I'm fairly confident that will be safe and we will be able to sit socially distant, because everyone that is going to be following the protocol. So I plan to work Pacers games on Friday, Sunday, Monday, and experience just a little bit of the madness on Saturday like everyone else. And so I think that'll be great to experience. As you said, I probably won't tempt myself into peeking into the court because I don't want to get in trouble, but I do share a bathroom, I think, with the fans, because the closest bathroom that I have is in the hallway there, right next to maybe section 2 or 3. So I'm at least going to walk around a little bit, and I just will have that extra bounce in my step and pep in my voice just from having that building being busy. And Sunday's game will be even more interesting because we'll have the sunlight coming in with a 1 o'clock Pacers game in Miami. And I don't even know if we know the times of the college games at Bankers Life Fieldhouse on Sunday. But one additional final thought that I think is even cool about this for both of us is when I was downtown today, I saw a few friends that work for Ball State, and there will be a Ball State feel inside Bankers Life Fieldhouse, because Ball State is actually the host of the games at Bankers Life Fieldhouse. So chirp, chirp. I know they'll all do a great job, and I know everyone in the state will do a fantastic job as well. You just hope that all the players, it's got to be even tough for them. They're getting to experience this. Many of them were robbed of the opportunity last year, but they've got to kind of stay inside that bubble as well. And so it's so many mixed emotions, but I just know that compared to where we were a year ago, it's a completely different feeling, and one of more optimism. And so we're excited to watch the college basketball and to report on the NBA and really see what happens over the next couple of months for both.
Yeah, I think especially as we've hit this period now where we would officially be in the start of lockdown a year ago, I think that's when especially my perspective has come to the point of what you just said. I've been thinking this way all year. We've been so lucky to have a season, get to be at half the games, get to do broadcasts for all of them. There was a long time where stuff was up in the air, but you know, to be in now the point where things would have shut down last year, and you and I are getting ready to go do a game here on Wednesday. In a lot of ways, that is just such a major victory. And I, you know, try to take consideration of that. You know, just a couple of stray thoughts I had before we close this out. I don't know if you know, I don't have the schedule memorized, but I did take a look and it appears as if, now, unfortunately, he won't be able to be there for it, but it does appear as if the timing is good for Doug McDermott and Creighton. In fact, I think Creighton might be one of those Saturday games playing at Lucas Oil Stadium. Is that the one you're going to? Do you know?
No, I'll be at the second game. And when you purchased the tickets, it was basically a session and a game. You know, back in the right day, you always got two games for one because there were usually four games at each site for that first day, and you would either have an afternoon and a night session. Now it seems like there are three per day with much more time between games. And so it was just a random, well, I'll pick the middle of the day so there's a chance it's not the 10 o'clock start. And, you know, just kind of, actually it was whatever I could get as well. And it happens to be Oklahoma and Missouri. So that's an 8-9 matchup. It should be good game. I'm actually going to go with a couple of people that are Purdue fans. So they are partial to Konzo Martin. So they were happy about seeing that. They were, of course, hoping it would just randomly luck out that it would be Purdue playing in that game. But I think it'll be a good experience. And the other one that I think I should mention, you mentioned Doug McDermott. Gonzaga is playing at Bankers Life Fieldhouse in what I believe is the final day game of the day on Saturday. So it's actually perfect for Domas if he did have the ability to go. And like I said, I don't know what the rules the players are following when they're at home. I'm sure he could be in there in a suite and be able to follow all of the rules, but I don't know that he will be able to do that. And I'm not even sure. I'm not going to ask him that. I did ask him a few weeks ago about Gonzaga and how much he had been watching them, just because I know he's been such a fan of his school since joining the NBA. And he admitted that he'd been watching so many games and this is their best chance ever to win the championship. And so it will be cool for him. I hope he can just participate just a little bit. Most likely, I'm guessing, though, he'll be the one that is just, you know, from across the street doing a Zoom pep talk for his school that came to his city. So that's crazy. But Gonzaga and Creighton do seem like the two schools with connections to the Pacers that, you know, have a good chance. And the other, I suppose, would be Michigan with Caris LeVert.
Right. Okay, before I let you go, I want you really quickly to please hit on something for me, because I haven't had the chance to go back and watch this, but I kind of saw it happening on television as we were broadcasting the game. And so I'll just kind of set the table with what I know. I saw the notes that we get that are the TV broadcast notes that had a potential trivia question of Eddie Gill being from Aurora, Colorado. And as you go on anywhere on the internet, whether it's ESPN or Wikipedia, or Basketball Reference, it shows he's from Aurora, Colorado. And is all of that wrong?
That is wrong. Yes. I didn't actually prep Eddie, and I'm not sure that he's was actually listening when the trivia question went on the first time. This is, in TV terms, what we call it was time to pay it off and give the answer. And so I knew I had seen it in the notes, and our VP of Broadcasting and Director for the games, Jamie Burns, said, let's get, you know, Eddie on the headset, so when we pay it off, he can comment about being the only Pacers player born in the state of Colorado. And he just looked at me, and it wasn't like he was offended, but there was a little bit of like, but I wasn't born in Colorado. That's wrong. And I'm like, oh, all right, well, and there's like 30 seconds left in the commercial, and I was like, well, we have a sponsor obligation.
Right.
So, I don't even know if the graphic can be changed to, the answer is zero. It's a trick question. No. Right.
That wouldn't make any sense.
So, and then the worst part about it was, this was a plan to execute it the first time out of the fourth quarter before presumably the game gets really good and you don't want to, you know, steer attention from what's happening on the court. But it was right in the middle of that run where the basketball was probably as bad as it could have gotten from a Pacers perspective. So they did pick a time where they could do it. And popped Eddie on, and Chris was like, well, let JJ do it. And I was like, wait a second. I never do this. You know, I was like, you want to blame me for the wrong trivia question? So we had both the, we called the two box ready, and Chris and off camera set up the question. And then Eddie explained that, you know, Wikipedia is in fact wrong. And I said, well, it's not just Wikipedia. It's Basketball right. Reference.
It's everything. Radar.
Yeah. I mean, we had three sources on this, and the other bad part was, as much as we wanted to kind of go back and forth a little bit, I think the Nuggets scored like two baskets while this was happening. And so we got out of it, and it was funny. And I thought immediately we got to say where he was born. And
right.
That was kind of the cliffhanger that no one was able to answer. And we had to get back to the game, and we couldn't even come back to it because it was just such a downer the rest right. of the way. And so even Jake Query, a friend of many of us in the media, had texted Eddie and said, well, all right, well, where were you born then? So it's like, yeah, and he was getting that from a lot of people. So we were able to spend a segment of the postgame show, a city in New Jersey, which now I've already forgotten. But hopefully someone can get on Wikipedia. And I challenge you, you're the biggest Basketball Reference expert that I know. See if you can get that corrected on Basketball Reference. We did have to ask, like, you know, you did play for the Grizzlies and the Nets, and your stats are right, correct? You are an NBA player. You were not born in Aurora, Colorado.
Yeah, maybe he's been playing the long con. Like, he didn't even play in the NBA. This is a completely
exactly.
different guy.
Yeah. I mean, he's a good enough broadcaster now. I think he would keep his job, but I may not ask him all of the inside basketball questions if it's not true. But, you know, it was kind of a fun moment. And I will say, you know, just to kind of my final thought on this podcast, it was such an unusual game. It was a bummer at the end, but there were so many things that happened, both on the broadcast for us and then just watching on the court, that it's maybe one I won't soon forget. When you combine, we had a smothered chicken for the first time in over 2 years. Miles just had some incredible individual performances. We had that eight offensive rebounds for the Nuggets on one possession, and they didn't even score. And then we had that unique moment with the trivia question and Eddie Gill's fake birth hometown. So that was kind of a fun night, even though it didn't end well. And we'll see what happens on Wednesday. You never know what you're going to get when you watch Pacers basketball.
Well, I'll tell you, a couple years ago, Wheat Hodgkiss and I, Wheat works for our digital team. You've read his articles on the website. We tried to get TJ Leaf's information changed on Wikipedia because TJ does not want the dots in there. And Wikipedia did not let us change it. We would change it and they would change it back. And we would say, no, we work for the team. Here's the documentation that he doesn't want the dots. And Wikipedia wouldn't take it because it's within their style guide to have the dots. So we'll see. I'm not overly optimistic that we can get that changed on Wikipedia. I was able to get Stephanie White's name back in the day. It was back to her. Her previous last name was on Basketball Reference, and I was able to get that one changed. So maybe I'll have more luck with our friends over at Basketball Reference, who, you know, I think very highly of. But I will say, as far as Twitter teases go, I think you had the tease of the year with Eddie Gill's birthplace coming up after the break. So
it was almost 1 o'clock in the morning, and
right.
we do see viewership tail off after a loss. Especially a disappointing loss. So I don't know how many were still watching, and then if you were watching, how many were just randomly scrolling through Twitter. So it may not have been as effective, but at least we were able to have a little bit of fun on the post-game show, and we were kind of bummed out about the fourth quarter.
All right. Well, that'll wrap it up for this week. On Wednesday, if you are listening to this on a Wednesday, Pacers and Nets are upcoming. Should be a really fun one. The Nets are playing terrifically. The Pacers are back at the Fieldhouse. Pacers.com/tickets for any games in the future. They are socially distanced and all the protocols are in place. If you can't make it, JJ starts 30 minutes before each game on TV. We start 30 minutes before each game on the radio side. Would love to have you over there. For JJ, I'm Pat. We will talk to you next week on the Sideline Guys podcast.